This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, May 4th, 2021, on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. On today's show, a preview of one of the sessions in the upcoming University of Arkansas Honors College Forum about COVID-19 vaccines. A conversation with Trish Starks, a professor of history, coming up. And our second half hour today features the second installment of the podcast Reflections, this week featuring the Imani Winns, Antoinette Grajeda, and Leah Uribe, and the Reflections team later on our program. And a note about today's show, it includes all new material, but it's being produced with an early deadline. So we don't have updates regarding Arkansas Department of Health numbers regarding COVID-19 or other news from the past day or so. But you can keep up with the news every weekday morning at 5:30 and 7:30 on KUAF with Antoinette Grajeda. And our shows the rest of this week will provide us a chance to rest and listen again to some interviews and stories from previous shows. This is Ozarks at Large. A year and one day ago on our show, we invited Trish Starks, professor of history at the University of Arkansas, onto our show to give us a preview of an Honors College session she was going to lead about the history of pandemics. Now, 366 days later, we've invited her back to talk about another forum she'll lead for the Honors College, part of a two-week series of sessions about vaccines. She'll lead a forum about the history of vaccines. We asked her what the past 12 months have been like for her, a student of medical history, watching history unfold every single day.
Yes. I have been surprised. As a Russianist, as a historian of the worst, all I can think of is the Mel Brooks song from the 12 Chairs. Hope for the best, expect the worst. And that has been playing through my mind. If there is one song of the pandemic for me, it has been that it is hope for the best, expect the worst. And yet I have been astonished at how bad things have gotten and the levels of where that worst can be. In some ways, definitely recalibrated the way that I teach, the way that I think about the history of disease, the way I think about the possibilities of modern medicine. And you and I have talked before, I'm not necessarily an unjaundiced view of modern medicine. I'm always very skeptical of the heroics and the miraculous and the pictures that lack a shade of gray. And yet my picture of the past has grown a bit darker as we have lived through a year of shadow.
Well put. And as you and I talk, of course, the planet is at one of its worst stages for infections. We're seeing it rage through India where there's not enough oxygen and not enough space to take care of the sick. We are anything but out of this as a global citizenry.
Yes. And yet, you know, in the back of your mind, as we're finishing the semester here at the university and looking towards the fall semester and how our class is going to be, we're planning for an in-person in the fall. We're, you know, we are hopeful. We are constantly hoping for the best.
Right.
And moving forward with that idea. And that is the other thing that even as I've been astonished at how badly it has gone in many cases, I am also constantly amazed at the speed and strength of the response from scientists and researchers. And that's what's great about this class. If our last class was a class as we were coming into the worst of it, just starting into lockdowns, just starting into some of the worst waves here in the United States, in New York and elsewhere. Now we're looking at it from that hopeful side. Right. We're looking at it from the side of vaccine. We're looking at it from this, again, just amazing outpouring and quick identification of the virus, identification of therapeutics, identifications of methods of containing spread, and then identification of vaccines. And it's such a relatively young field in the history of medicine to see it moving this quickly and to see it moving into these new directions of research and RNA vaccines, which are exceedingly new, and to have them be so successful so quickly is hopeful. So it tamps down the Russianist within me.
That's great. Yeah, the title of the session that you're going to be leading the discussion on is History of Vaccines, Politics of the Present. Let's look at the history of vaccines, because vaccines, compared to medicine as a whole, have a relatively brief history, right?
Right. I mean, I'm going to take my time in the course to talk about one particular set of questions, the question of smallpox and the development of the smallpox vaccine with Edward Jenner. And, you know, he publishes his findings in the 1790s. It's not that long ago in historian speak. That's not that far. And he's considered the father of vaccinology. He's considered the father of the field. And we'll talk about smallpox and his development of vaccine and how, you know, how he's really kind of a tinkerer. He's a naturalist. He's not really, this isn't his only field of inquiry.
Given, you know, smallpox and polio and the time it took and the battles that had to be done in the lab to get these successful vaccines, this is unprecedented what we have seen in the speed that Pfizer and Moderna and J&J were developed.
And the speed and the relative success. I mean, if we look at how each one of them has been really quite effective, and surprisingly effective on variants, most of them too. It's just awe-inspiring. Again, a little hopeful. I'm just shocked at the end of this to be a little hopeful.
These vaccines kind of, you know, they had a public-private sort of partnership because of the enormity of the pandemic. I'm wondering what you know about Jenner in the late 18th century. Was he on his own? Did he have help? Did he have patrons?
He paid to self-publish.
Wow.
He paid to publish the thing. But he does become a cause celeb. Once Jennerization, it becomes the way that Europe wants to be introduced and to inoculation. And he is celebrated by the state. He's celebrated across Europe. His ideas become very, very pronounced and quite lauded, as does he. But yeah, at first he's kind of celebrated. He's kind of on his own. And then we think about the same with Salk, that, you know, he is funded through March of Dimes, through public public donations that are set off by Roosevelt and set off by, you know, kind of a higher presence, but it's largely a public funded effort. And that's actually, if people talk about that actually getting in the way of greater vaccine development, that as people have looked more towards private efforts or towards, you know, public charitable organizations to develop vaccines rather than government funding, it's led to kind of drying up of government funds. It's led to groups not being interested in the development because vaccines aren't big money. And so it actually, that kind of move towards more private funding, more charitable funding has been problematic in development of more vaccines.
In the 18th century, how big a problem was smallpox?
Smallpox was a massive problem. 3 in 10 people, when you get smallpox, 3 in 10 people in the wild, viral mm-hmm. smallpox, 3 in 10 will die. That's in a population that has had some exposure. They estimate that in some populations, virgin populations that hadn't had previous exposure, in the Americas, for example, when explorers come over, and we have a massive outbreak in the 16th century, they estimate some areas it might have been 50 to 70%.
Wow.
Mortality rate from smallpox. And even people that don't die, it's horribly painful. These pustules form on the body. They form craters in the skin that can be longstanding, that can be with you for life. You lose your eyelashes, you lose your eyebrows, all sorts of problems that come. You can be disfigured. You can be blinded by smallpox. In addition to, you know, just death, there are all of these other outgrowths. And it's estimated that it killed about 400,000 people a year in Europe, responsible for about a third of the cases of blindness. It just is a massive killer. So, yeah, it's a big problem. And so people are looking for ways to survive it. But we're also going to talk about King Carlos IV of Spain and inoculation in the Americas. So King Carlos IV, he had a horrendous time with smallpox. His family has a lot of problem. His brother is lost to smallpox, his sister-in-law, his three-year-old daughter. And so he variolates his entire family. And in 1798, declares the entire civilian population of Spain should be variolated. And then once Jenner comes up with his ideas and he finds out about that, he pushes the idea that they need to do this for the entire New World, all of the Spanish colonial areas of the New World. However, laudable, right? Great, great idea. To do that, they need to get... the lymph, they have to get a viable amount of cowpox to the New World. To do that, they use a chain of 22 orphans, starting off in Spain. And after those two get to the point where they can be turned into infectious agents for the next two, to the next two, to the next two over a series of months, so that they can bring that infectious matter to the New World, where they will inoculate over 500,000 people. I mean, it's massive, massive. But they do it by basically using children as mules for the virus.
So, okay, one last question connecting these vaccines that we've got now to those. I've been amazed at how a shot in 2021 doesn't hurt. I barely, you know, I look away. I don't know what's happening. It's over in a matter of seconds. What was it like to get a shot? Do we know what it was like to get a shot in to get immunized against smallpox?
When it comes to Jenner's form, what they would do is they would use a lancet, which is basically an abrasive tool, and cut into the skin and then smear pustule matter over that cut in the skin. And that's one of the things that leads to certain amounts of vaccine hesitancy in the 19th century is because people start to confer on it that it's the mark of the beast. Again, you have this kind of worry about mixing of cows with humans. And then also you have this scarring that would last for the rest of your life. I mean, of course, I still have my inoculation scar from when I was inoculated years back. I know kids don't get that anymore, darn it. but, you know, that mark was one that was seen as a reason that people refused to get it. And then there's also just one of the reasons for vaccine hesitancy in the 19th century in England will be that inoculation takes place in poorhouses and in other points that are already seen as areas not where upstanding people would go. And then they would just take and abrade the arms of multiple people and then just move the lymph from arm to arm. And so there's this worry of contagion with the people around you too. Mm. So not just that you're getting lymph from cows, but actually by the 19th century, we've moved into a different kind of lymph. It's no longer cowpox lymph. It's anyway, technical issues aside, the movement of the lymph from arm to arm, people were worried it was going to carry syphilis. People were worried it had a moral contagion to it, so that, you know, you might end up with the problems of the people next to you, because again, they're not quite sure of the difference between inheritance and disease and where are these things mixing out in the 19th century. So they're worried that things might be passed on with that movement of the lymph. And so the techniques of the time also added to these problems. But, you know, these techniques are such interesting things. If you think back to, you know, back to those orphan chains and how do we solve that? Same thing that we were talking about in whatever fall of this year, last year, where it's like, oh, well, the Moderna has to be stored at such and such degree.
Right.
How do we do that? How do we change that? And they're dealing with it in Spain in the early 19th century. How do we transfer this to the new world? How do we keep this in a viable state? So we have these same questions, just different answers and different vulnerabilities shown at each point, right?
Yeah. Well,
because I mean, then it was the kids that were put on the chopping block, so to speak, and with the Moderna and the Pfizer, it was a question of, well, how do we get this beyond urban areas where they have the technology? And so it's always a question of how are the vulnerable either going to be harmed by this process or helped, and how can we try and balance that to be most effective? Because we're finding out in a way that they didn't know then, but we're finding out even more how interconnected our world is, how much if we don't help everyone out, those variants are going to become a problem for everyone, and that that it has to be a group solution.
Trish Starks is a professor of history at the University of Arkansas. She'll lead one of the sessions of UA Honors College devoted to vaccines. The sessions begin Monday, that's May 10th. And those sessions will be open to members of the community and also recorded for later viewing as well. You can learn more by following a link that we've provided at OzarksAtLarge.com.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Phoenix Arts, newly organized nonprofit co-op at Mount Sequoia Center in Fayetteville, is hosting Pronouns, a trans and non-binary group show, the weekend of May 7th. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich met with the co-curators to bring us this story.
More Americans are embellishing their digital signatures with pronoun choices to declare their gender identity. The political gesture works to build solidarity with LGBTQ+ Americans who continue to battle on the front lines for equality and justice.
My pronouns are she, her, hers.
My pronouns are she, he, and they.
My pronouns are she, her, hers.
That's transgender civil rights activist Jewel Hayes, Phoenix artist Pat Hennin, and Lori Foster, board president of Phoenix Art, who couldn't quite sort out her pronouns. On May 7th, Phoenix Art is hosting Pronouns, a trans and non-binary group show. This is co-curator Pat Hennin.
My involvement is meeting Jewel Hayes, and we talked and we decided that we wanted to co-curate a show about the trans cultural community in mostly in Northwest Arkansas, and represent a group that is marginalized often and doesn't have access to the kind of opportunities to show and who they are through their art.
Jewel Hayes says she and Hennin have been planning this show for 6 months.
The purpose of this exhibition is to give the opportunity for trans people to speak about their experience, but also give the opportunity for all people to learn that you don't have to be specifically the perfect man or the perfect woman. You can just be uniquely yourself, and everybody should have a unique balance of their masculine and feminine energies that they are comfortable with.
Hayes says 8 artists will be featured.
We have sculpture, we have oils, we have paintings, some spoken word poetry, even a VR project where we will be exhibiting a VR live performance.
Referring to virtual reality, the opening scheduled for Friday, May 7th from 5 to 7 p.m. is not virtual.
This will be a socially distanced event with a live video stream broadcasted outside of the building.
Last winter, Phoenix Fayetteville shuttered its downtown commercial gallery, reorganized, and moved to the Miller Building on the crest of Mount Sequoia, says Lori Foster, with a new name, Phoenix Art.
We try to have very innovative shows. We want to be inclusive. We want to showcase artists that maybe don't normally have gallery representation. We want to kind of be a sounding board and a place where artists can collaborate with other artists and create venues that will involve the public and just do things a little bit differently than a standard gallery.
Phoenix Arts hosts performance art and interactive events, including a panel discussion with Pronouns artists, to take place Saturday, May 8th at 6 p.m. This is Jewel Hayes.
The panel discussion will give trans artists and non-binary artists an opportunity to speak about their art and speak about how they want it to influence the world around them.
Non-binary refers to people whose identity is fluid, neither male nor female.
There are as many pronouns as the rainbow, but most people just use the typical ones, she, her, he, him, they, them. There's also people whose pronouns change depending on their day. It just is what you feel comfortable with. You can call yourself whatever you like, and that's about freedom.
Some say as many as 78 gender pronouns exist now to account for identities such as gender neutral, agender, pangender, two-spirit, and indigenous identity, and more, as well as sexual identities, which is why the acronym LGBTQ continues to gain letters.
Lesbian, bi, transgender, queer, intersex, and asexual. But we are all queer and we're all birds of a feather, so we're all one together.
During the exhibition and public talk, patrons will learn about gender identity, which can be the same or different from the sex assigned at birth, gender expression, the external appearance of gender identity, and transgender identity. Pronouns, exhibition works are for sale, and Phoenix Art is accepting donations at the door. To learn more, visit Phoenix Art, that's F-E-N-I-X, on Facebook. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. Ozarks at Large is Antoinette Grajeda and Leo Uribe, the host of our Sound Perimeter every Thursday on Ozarks, have created a new episode of Reflections, exploring music and its value to our world. This time it's music, social justice, and the Imani Winds. Here is the second installment of Reflections.
Welcome to Reflections. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I am Leo Uribe.
Later on, we'll be joined by our colleague Rogelio Garcia Contreras as well, as we speak to Imani Winds. As part of the Reflections music series, the Grammy-nominated ensemble has been participating in a virtual residency that has included master classes, conversations, and a panel discussion with Northwest Arkansas arts leaders. Leo, why was this a group that you wanted to work with and highlight as part of the series?
Antoinette, this is such a great opportunity we had to connect with a group of musicians. Again, at the Center of Reflections, we want to bring to our community citizen artists. We want to connect with them and have discussions at that level. And Imani Winds have been at the forefront of these discussions and this advocacy and this high level of musicianship for the 24 years of their existence. So for me, as a bassoonist, I grew up looking up to Imani because I saw that they were doing these things that I wanted to do one day, which was playing music by people that looked like me or sounded like me from my culture, from their culture, being represented by a woman, a powerful woman in the bassoon, you know, identity, but then in the musician, arts administrator, everything that they do. So I thought that because of their trajectory and also because they are and have been mostly an African-American group of musicians. And I found that very relevant, especially at this time in which we are framing all of these conversations through the lens of racial justice.
Imani Winds includes Mark Dover on clarinet, Monica Ellis on bassoon, Brandon Patrick George on flute, Jeff Scott on French horn, and Toyin Spellman-Diaz on oboe. Founding members Monica and Toyin joined us for today's discussion. Over the last year, calls for racial justice have been such a huge focal point in a lot of areas, and it's had a profound impact on art. Your latest album, Brutes, while you produced the album last summer, I read that the music was actually written 4 years earlier. So how did the events last summer surrounding the murder of George Floyd influence or change that music that you already had on hand?
When all of the poop show went down last year, and when George Floyd was tragically murdered, we were already in the middle of a pandemic. So we were already kind of shut down as far as music making goes. And we were kind of drifting and not knowing what we were going to do when next. But kind of the moment when George Floyd was murdered and there were other horrible, senseless violent acts committed over the summer, and it kind of focused us. And all of a sudden we realized what we had to do, which was get our butts in gear and get this this album really happening in the next few months. So this was really our way of having a musical expression that spoke to the times while we couldn't literally play. So it added an urgency. The summer added an urgency to our producing of this CD. And we are very, very proud of what has come of it, because every piece on there speaks to social justice, but in a, not necessarily in a direct way. The pieces are all about understanding each other better or unpacking an idea. Like the title track of the CD, Brutes by Vijay Iyer, he wrote it about Trayvon Martin and the trial that was going on at that time and of his murder. And so he happened to be in residence in Florida at the time, a place where all sorts of other crazy stuff is happening now and was happening then too. He wrote it about the trial and the Stand Your Ground law. And so while in this performance of this recording, we speak the words of the Stand Your Ground law. So we've never done anything that direct before, actually, I gotta say, politically. This is the most direct we've ever been with a political statement, but it was the time to do such a thing. We recorded this in 2019. 2020 was even more relevant. In 2021, it just seems to become more and more relevant as time goes on.
Chapter 776, Justifiable Use of Force. Use of force in defense of person. A person is justified in using force except deadly force against another when and to the extent that the person reasonably believes that such conduct is necessary to defend himself or herself or another against the other's imminent use of unlawful force.
You mentioned the pandemic and you know, already being in the pandemic when George Floyd was killed and that kind of escalating things. How did the pandemic impact the way that you typically do what you do as Imani Wins? Obviously, touring stopped for basically everyone. But I was listening to an interview and I understand you were able to continue sort of this advocacy work in terms of this arena that you had stepped into a little more focused with people reaching out to you, wanting to have these conversations. Can you tell me a little bit about what that was like? Was that something that you intentionally did, you know, to have these conversations about more equitable ensembles, or was it something that people started reaching out to you for?
I would say it was more the latter. It was more the latter. Conversations around the overt conversations around what was happening, the racial reckoning that, you know, that's kind of this all-purpose terminology that was applied to the events of last summer. And it is applicable, but it's also, I think it's a It's the type of term that we have to put into context because there's been many racial reckonings. There's been many times when conversations have taken place and over different periods of time. They're calling, I've heard another terminology of, is this the next Reconstruction, the third Reconstruction, one being when it actually happened post-Civil War, the next one in the 60s for the during the Civil Rights era. And now is this yet again, is this happening again, you know, or are we really ready to build again? So in any event, when these conversations were happening, I think we were thrusted into them more because of what was occurring as opposed to it just being a natural thing that we would have done anyway. But at the same time, we were primed for it because of the work that we've been doing and have done, and because of what we represent, the music that we play, the people that we are. There was definitely a hyper focus, a spotlight put on it. And I think all of us, myself and Toyin especially, though, we all felt ready to take the mantle of, you know, and have these talks. And we felt, I at least personally felt empowered by each other, empowered to see Anthony McGill do what he did. Garrett McQueen, a bassoonist who's, you know, very forthright in his thoughts about social justice. And then some of our larger organizations, IDR, the International Double Reed Society, and that we're a part of as oboe and bassoon players, and, you know, organizations that are predominantly white, but that you do know fit into that valid allyship position, were taking stances. So, you know, you did, I felt a sense of gratefulness that they were happening, that the conversations were happening. At the same time, we also saw where it was somewhat disingenuous, that there were times where people were just being reactionary and saying, oh, you know, here's my Black Lives Matter statement. And maybe not in a malicious way, but just in an uninformed way, you know, producing these statements. So that was yet another conversation to have, you know, well, are you just doing this because you don't want to get canceled? Yet another conversation. But, you know, or do you actually have some concrete receipts, as they say, to back it up, to to back up your platforms? And so all of this, I think, has lended itself to progress, which ebbs and flows. Progress is a funny thing. You know, it's two steps forward, one step back. Is it still progress? Yes. So it's all kind of the thing that you are in, you're kind of inundated in it, and it's happening around you and it's happening together and you're a part of it. But then a year from now, I think we can look back on it and say, how did we really act in the face of all of this? And were certain things the right way to go? So, you know, it's all just very, very interesting as to how things will pan out. But yes, the conversations absolutely occurred whether we wanted to have them or not. And so we were happy to be a part of them and continue to be, obviously, through things like this.
Your words just reminded me the words of American artist Titus Capehart, whose art and paintings I strongly recommend. He says that he believes there is beauty in hearing the voices of people who haven't been heard. And he also states that this is a complex affair because the things that must be said are not always beautiful or lovely. But if they reveal the truth, they are fundamentally beautiful and lovely. So how do you think you are giving voice to those who haven't been heard through your music, through the art that you produce?
That's a great question. Because music, or especially instrumental music, we don't normally have words to what we're saying. So it's very much dissipated. And so I think what we're doing is we personify the emotion or the ideas behind something in a much more fundamental way that goes beyond. People always talk about how music is universal, which I don't necessarily agree with, but I'll come back there in a minute. But what we do is there are these compositions called songs without words. And so I think what we as instrumentalists do is we speak these truths without words in a way that is more compelling sometimes, because you don't know exactly what we're trying to say. if we're doing it right, which Imani Wins tries to do, we're conveying something very powerful through this music, and we're very carefully picking music that says things to us that we hope with some. We often, when we perform, we speak before we play, so it's pretty easy to tell what we're thinking. But the power of music is you can listen to it without those words and still have very interesting emotive responses.
And just really quickly, you know, voice to the voiceless, you know, power to the powerless, like that's the key. That's really what all of this is about at the end of the day. I think that so many of us have just been demoralized and you know, downright just discriminated against for so many years on various levels that, you know, in whatever way you can, in whatever medium you are putting your place in the world, ours happens to be music. I think in some capacity, we have to find ways to do exactly what you said. You know, we music and art for art's sake is fine, but and by the way, we love that. But there has to be a time. There has to come a point in time where you are bigger than your that your music is bigger than just your space right here. And if you don't recognize that, then you're not only doing the audience a disservice, but yourself a disservice as the artist, I think. To put yourself in this vacuum and not say, how can I help somebody freaking else, for Pete's sake, you know? How can we not help people? Like, how is this possible that you can just sort of think that you live in this little box and my music, it's just my thing and here you are. It's just, we do not have that option. We do not have that luxury. So you have to think bigger and find those to pick up along the way and help.
That is beautiful, Monica and Toyin, and thank you for sharing that so powerfully. The world of classical music is in balance, like you mentioned. And in a conversation we had a couple of weeks ago, you said something really powerful that has stayed with me, is our existence as a tool of resistance. We exist to intervene and to disrupt and to create new consciousness. And I would like for both of you to tell us, how do you do that? And what is the emotional labor that type of a you know, that brings to you at every level, because it's not easy, even though you have a platform that you have created strongly for 24 years, to appear with all of these different repertoire, different, you know, ways of connecting with your audiences, different messages in the music and the composers you work with. So can you speak on that behalf a little bit?
First of all, the main way that we make a difference is by existing as an ensemble of musicians of color and going to places where people might not have ever seen an ensemble with musicians of color before. So that means to the most prestigious concert hall. And it also means going to Native American reservations and performing for people who have never seen other people other than white people playing this music. It's how we hear and how we see. Like, as musicians, we don't just go there and play. We're also there to acknowledge our audience. I think musicians often forget this, that we're not just playing with a big glass box around us. You know, there's people we're playing for who we speak to after the concert, who people of color who see us play. And they say, man, I have never seen a Black bassoonist before. And we say, well, we're here to tell you that we exist. And we get to talk to people who've never seen people of color playing these instruments, and they play them too. And so we serve as an example to them that is really, I know, because I was lucky enough to have examples of people of color who played music when I was growing up. So it was very important to me, and it is so important to me to pass that on to the next generation of young musicians who are out there and see them and hear them, because a lot of them are hurting in these organizations. There's also the idea of what we play, the music that we all choose to play, the composers we get to play who are marginalized. I know a lot through my work this in this past year. I've seen a lot of professors who are doing the good work and trying to play music by composers of color, by women, by people in the LGBTQ community. And they're making an effort to make sure that all voices are heard. So I think for us, the main thing though, is just to keep acknowledging who we are and keep putting ourselves out there and keep this mission of playing music from everybody, for everybody, and make it more of a communal experience.
Yeah, that's also a great question. And I wrote it down, Leah, because I wanted to remember you just asked, you said the words emotional labor, I believe you just said, like, what kind of toll does it take on us? And that's an interesting way to form it, because we don't talk about that as much. We don't talk about how hard these things are. And yes, it does take a particularly, it can take a toll on us to just be constantly in the work versus enjoying the work and being about the accolades of the work. It takes a certain constitution. It takes a certain resilience in your own self. And so, you know, all of us happen to be very strong people, I think. We come from strong stock. So that is a good thing that enables us to feel empowered to do the work. So we, I think, show that. And the act of showing that empowers others. It's not just about seeing our Black faces playing the instruments, but seeing the power within it, like how what we put into it, not just literally us walking on stage, but you know, when you hear the noise coming out of our instruments, they sense that power, they sense that resolute, that resolve. And I feel like that is very inspiring to people, that alone allows for, you know, you to feel like I'll keep fighting my fight in whatever lane I'm in. And I think even with the classics that we play, the so-called standard repertoire, not the marginalized composers, Mozart, Beethoven, Shostakovich, you know, we play this music. And even within that, I feel is an empowering thing, because it just goes to show we have a right to that music too. It's not some proprietary situation we're walking in here. You know, you have a right to this music that has lived for hundreds of years, just as much as our white counterparts. Feel compelled to go after it. Don't think you only have to focus as a Black singer on the spirituals. I was just having this conversation with a dear friend of Toy and mine both, Derek Gay, who is a fantastic thinker and doing incredible work in his own right of DEI. And he's also a singer of ours, friend of ours from Oberlin. And you know, we joke around all the time, but it's like, yep, here comes the spirituals, because you're Black and because you're a singer, you know, that's, you're just confined to that. And So yes, I think playing the music that doesn't necessarily represent our culture is just as important as the other, to not pigeonhole yourself and to not to show the breadth in which we can encompass this genre of music.
We have a very diverse community in Northwest Arkansas. We have a large amount of Marshallese people, Latinx people, you name it, also here in Fayetteville because of the university. What do you tell those kids from diverse communities that want to be musicians, that want to enter the world in this very same moment and be relevant and change and contribute to changing these parameters and to contribute to a new balance in the world of music?
One thing I say, or we say, is to all musicians, because I feel like everyone can be a part of change. People who are marginalized and people who are not marginalized. So I think as far as musicians go, a lot of times we don't think we have the power to make something change. So I've spent a lot of time asking musicians, young musicians, what do you want to do when you get out of school? And a lot of them have no idea, not one single idea. They just want some sort of thing to happen. So I spent a lot of time talking through people like, who do you want to play for is an excellent place to start with a young musician. Who do you want to have see in your audience? And then that leads to conversations of protecting the marginalized or empowering the marginalized or being more yourself if you're trans or if you're a person of color. And so I think that's, we support people through our dollars, our lives, our words, and also we can do it through our music. So I think that's a new concept to a lot of these students we're talking to. And I'm so excited. It's so much fun to open up students' eyes to what they can achieve with just a little more intent.
And the only thing I would just add is that I think the best we can do, not only for musicians of color that do come from traditionally marginalized communities, but for everyone of a certain age, trying to find what your authentic self really is. And that's, I think, you know, another way of just saying what Toya is talking about, asking them questions. That's, I think, not what has occurred. That has not occurred so much in our educational capacity. You know, we, the student asks the questions, the student comes to the teacher, the student is constantly saying, you know, am I doing this right? Am I doing that right? The teacher is constantly just talking at the student, not necessarily engaging them in the music industry. I mean, I think we see this in a more liberal arts type of education. We see discussions happening. We see, you know, more of a give and take rapport, making sure we're educating students that will ask questions of others in order to make the world a better place. But in the music world, especially classical, are we doing that so much? I don't know. I don't know that we're really doing that to the point where we are going to make these really cognizant and sensitive and thoughtful 21st century musicians. If you're coming out of school at 21 years old and no one has ever asked you, how do you ultimately see your career unfolding? As Toyin just said, what kind of audiences do you want to play for? How can you cultivate those audiences? If we're not asking questions like that, then it's a disservice, I think, we're doing. I mean, Mark sometimes says, is it a Ponzi scheme? Is this whole classical music? I'm just calling him out. This whole classical music instruction, you know, what are we producing? There's only so many jobs. We have to offer other career thoughts to students. 9 times out of 10, it's like getting a job in the NBA. You're not going to get an orchestra job because there's just not enough slots. You know, people don't leave them. So but then at the same time, we can't just expect people to automatically know how to start a wind quintet or create their own careers. There's no blueprint for this stuff. So in whatever way we can, asking those questions in order to empower students is what we're constantly trying to do. And our festival that happens during the summer is a little 11-day, you know, love fest, really, for us and students. We just come together making music, but trying to integrate these questions and these thoughts into the sessions as well.
Our guests today were Monica Ellis and Toyin Spellman-Diaz, founding members of Imani Winds. So as we end today's episode, I do want to end with some reflections on the discussion, as we'd like to do. So Leah, what was your big takeaway from what we've heard today?
Antoinette, I have so many.
I know. It's a terrible question. It's so tough because it's like, how do you pick one when there's just so much to digest?
Right. And the name of our music series, Reflections, not Reflection.
That's true. I will give you more than one. I will give you that. Yes.
I was really touched by the compelling stories of each one of the Imani members mm-hmm. that participated with us, in different situations. So this was a compendium of perspective from day one with the first masterclass, preparation meetings, conversations, emails, everything that we used to connect and to really delve into this conversation together was very important for me as part of the leading team of Reflections Music Series. So I think that the big reflection, and perhaps I'm repeating myself, that it is the power of conversation And that the more we do this type of connection with artists and musicians, local and from the outside as well, and we connect them and we're having these honest, raw, difficult, and beautiful conversations, the more we're going to be able to move some change in this world that, you know, has been unbalanced. We feel it. I have to say it today. It's been very difficult to be in Arkansas these days. So many decisions are being made that affect our demographics, our constituents, our students, our audiences, our artists, you name it. So I think of art as the great equalizer when we use it that way. So the reflection is also in that regard. Let's continue using music and let's continue using our platforms to uplift marginalized communities, to uplift disenfranchised groups of people. That's the power we have. And I think we need to use art in that direction more than ever.
Well, that's a very good couple of reflections. I'm sure our listeners have some thoughts as well. And if they would like to share that with us, we'd love to hear from you. You can just send an email to reflections, that's with an X, so R-E-F-L-E-X-I-O-N-S, musicseries@gmail.com. And we just might share some of your thoughts in an upcoming episode. This podcast is created in conjunction with the Reflections Music Series. It's a project that receives support from many people, and we want to make sure we send our gratitude to them.
Absolutely. You know, we have some new sponsors. We were very lucky to get a grant from the Women's Giving Circle from the University of Arkansas that actually is directly connected with the production of this podcast. We're very thankful for that. And of course, the University of Arkansas Music Department, KUAF 91.3, Fulbright College and the Chancellor's Office, and the Arkansas Global Changemakers. I also am very thankful for faculty, staff, and students at the University of Arkansas Music Department that were very involved in supporting these conversations and in opening their spaces and giving their time for this residency. And I also want to thank our community partners that participated in the panel conversation, Social Impact Through the Arts, a couple of weeks ago. And they are Lakeisha Bradley from Mighty by Design Therapeutic Art Studios, Lulu Peredo from Engage Northwest Arkansas, Marisa Reyes from Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, and Alicia Smith, the Executive Director of Ideals Institute at the University of Arkansas.
Thanks to all of our sponsors, as well as our fellow team members, Erica Almenada, Helen Becue, Rogelio Garcia Contreras, Lawrence Hare, Olga Kokrayakova, Rhonda Mains, Tatiana Mendoza, Catalina Ortega, Bailey Ross, Eric Troiano, and Lee Wood. Thanks again to Amani Wins for their participation. We really, really appreciate everyone who continues to support this initiative. And of course, we'll be back with more music next time and a different performer. And so we look forward to that. If you'd like more information and want to keep up with what's happening, be sure to visit our website, reflectionsmusic.org. Until next time, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I am Leah Uribe.
And we'll see you then.
And a big thank you to Antoinette, Leah, and the entire crew involved in the production of Reflections. You can find previous installment of the podcast at KUAF.com. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Hiawassee. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Contributors today included Jacqueline Froelich, Antoinette Grajeda, and Leah Uribe. Daryl Sean is the writer and performer of our theme. It's titled First Hurrah. Timothy Dennis produced our show today in the Herald and Blanchcock News Studio. We are back tomorrow with an archive edition of our show, Archives on Ozarks at Large, made possible through support from the Women's Giving Circle at the University of Arkansas. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk again very soon.